When you earn your degree online at Arizona State University, you get everything the nation's most innovative university has to offer. The same internationally recognized faculty, the same nationally ranked programs, the same degree. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, as Jonathan DeBurka Butler was telling us recently on Around the World, there's a bit of tit-for-tat going on between North and South Korea. Balloons are being sent into the North attached to USB drives that contain K-pop and South Korean television, along with official government leaflets. In response to that, the North is sending back balloons attached to bags full of rubbish. And as petty as it sounds, this is just one example of psychological warfare. Graham Finlay from UCD has been looking at the history of this for us. Afternoon, Graham.
Afternoon, Sean.
So let's start at the border between North and South Korea. What things are they sending each other there?
Yeah, we could see this as either progress or as regress. So there was a whole agreement between North and South Korea not to do things like broadcast across the demilitarized zone and so forth. And relations have gotten to a bad place where volunteers and activists in South Korea have been sending over balloons with thousands of USB sticks with Korean, you know, soap operas and television on them and K-pop and things like that. And also leaflets and sort of medicine and food, things which are kind of short, not the leaflets, but short supply in North Korea. And North Korea has decided to show South Koreans what they think about these by sending trash over with balloons, over 1,000 balloons with trash, toilet paper. It doesn't tell us, mercifully, whether it was used or not. And so apparently they've checked them out, and they don't contain biohazards, but it's still unpleasant to have giant bags of trash landing in your garden.
Yeah, and could you categorize that as psychological warfare or just pettiness?
Yeah, no, really? Psychological warfare is interesting. So in response, South Korea is going to start up a program they agreed not to do previously, but that's broken down, which is to broadcast sort of propaganda, but also, again, K-pop, all sorts of other stuff across the demilitarized zone with really large speakers capable of broadcasting 20 kilometers inside North Korea. So that's loud.
Yeah, that right? is loud. Yeah.
And so it is psychological warfare, and it's an interesting way to think about this. So you got your soft power, which is where you put out stuff like music and you even promote the cuisine of your country to get people to like you and to want to emulate you, whether they're people who share your nationality or, the way the Koreans see themselves as doing, or whether it's other countries.
Right? Yeah.
But this is more like a hard power use of culture, because it's a way of sort of getting at and undermining the other country and annoying them in the case of North Korea. And I mean, so South Korea, my favorite part of this dispute was South Korea's asked North Korea to stop doing mean things. And that's an actual quotation.
Enough diplomatic language.
Now, this is better than, like, obviously shelling each other and shooting across the demilitarized zone, which also has been happening. But so it's a form of psychological warfare, which is everything from, again, playing like attractive music to, you know, really trying to manipulate and scare the other side into surrendering, basically, by showing your strength or by showing how well off you are.
But music, it seems, probably there's many examples in this century and the last century, but it's the use of music as psychological warfare is quite old.
Yeah, it is. It's really remarkable. So, I mean, people have been lobbing all sorts of horrible things over besieged castles' walls and towns' walls for ages. The Mongols like to use plague victims, but that actually didn't really work out, because if you're loading up plague bodies onto a catapult or something like that, the chance that you'll get the plague is extremely high.
Yeah,
so in fact, people get away from that. But music has always worked. And there's this ancient sort of horn called the sham, which is actually more of a wood instrument. So I don't know whether that makes it a proper horn. But it's very loud and can be played almost continuously. And so when the Crusaders went to the Middle East, or what is now the Middle East, in the 12th century, they came across a lot of Saracen units, whole units of people playing the sham and pounding on drums to rattle the Crusaders, both during battle and involving sieges and things like that.
Oh.
And they were so impressed that they took it up themselves. And this instrument spread to Western Europe from the Eastern Mediterranean, basically.
Yeah.
So it has been used for a long time. Obviously, with broadcast, you get lots of new powers to try and send music you like, and hopefully they don't like, across any kind of border or front line.
Yeah, but say like a Second World War and during the Cold War, this would have been used a lot, music, not just, I suppose, through big speakers, but radio stations.
Yeah, right? I mean, that new technology becomes incredibly powerful. And what's really striking is how it seems to characterize almost every conflict on both sides. You know, amazingly, you know, there's a whole network of stations called Voice of America, which was briefly controversial in the United States because I think Trump appointed a hardline ideologue over it, which upset people who obviously want their propaganda to be more neutral.
Yes.
It's been broadcasting since the Second World War, both sort of upbeat things about America and then maybe sort of downbeat things about whatever your enemy is. And it's still around. I mean, it broadcast all through the Cold War in all sorts of different regional areas. So they had special programs, special music programs even for Latin America to try and get people on side and to be anti-communist, you know, called, they had a program called Viva America. Radio Free Europe, which people might have heard of, was broadcasting and still basically exists. I'm not sure what its mission is exactly right now, but, you know, it's still, and would have jazz hours, right? You know, some of America's finest exports, along with the, you know, communism is terrible.
Yes.
You know, this is how people live on the other side of the Berlin Wall and other important programming like that.
And so what did they do then in the Soviet Union if these shows are being beamed into their territory?
Well, this is the actual genius part of this, which is it's very cheap, as you know yourself, to run a radio station.
Oh, yeah.
This place operates on pennies, I know. But no, it's relatively cheap to run to broadcast a radio program. But it's extremely expensive to jam it. So they found out that, you know, at the time, you know, for decades, the Soviet Union was paying $125 million a year to jam Radio Free Europe, whereas it didn't cost anything like that. You see, that was the entire budget for broadcasting altogether during that period. So it was an obvious win for the United States if the, you know, the Soviets were so concerned that they felt like they needed to jam it. The same thing was happening in Cuba, and Cuba famously doesn't have the resources to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the broadcasting was going the other way. And again, it involved a lot of music. Almost all the conflicts had their figure on the other side. People remember Lord Haha.
Yeah.
But also Hanoi Hannah is one of my own personal favorites, where she would exhort GIs to give up and talk about, you know how they're never going to win and things like that. But she would also play anti-war protest songs from the United States. So it was a bit like, you know, regular radio.
Basically.
And you had Tokyo Rose, you have like all of these broadcasters who very often people who'd learned English because they were, in the case of Tokyo Rose, who there were a bunch of different Tokyo Roses, but the most famous one was a woman who was in Japan just before Pearl Harbor visiting her grandparents and got trapped there.
Yeah.
and so found herself being drafted in to do English language broadcasting to the rest of the American occupying forces.
Yeah, that's it. Now, tell us about the Cod Wars, because I suppose from a distance, it almost seems kind of silly, though at the time it was deadly serious.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a really fascinating story because this is how we got the 200-mile nautical mile limit of our exclusive economic zones around Ireland, which is, you know, the bulk of Ireland is in the ocean or in the sea.
Mm.
And this is how we got it. So Iceland, which really, really cares about fishing, basically started unilaterally expanding what was they thought of as their exclusive fishing areas.
Yeah.
So this is all about fishing, right? Britain didn't like this because British fishermen had been fishing in these areas since like the 15th century, right? Or time immemorial, really. And this was in deadly earnest. There were three phases of the Cod Wars. Each one was where Iceland increased the limit more and more. But they were fought in a very unusual way. First of all, this is between two NATO members, which is unusual.
Yeah.
In fact, Iceland only triumphed by threatening to leave NATO, and its strategic importance was such that everyone has, oh, fine, have your 200-mile limit.
Mm.
The British were very committed to sort of open fishing, you know, as allegedly they are now. Anyway, there was serious violence. You know, they were shooting at each other, these ships, and you had trawlers from Britain escorted by Royal Navy ships being confronted by Icelandic Coast Guard units, you know, and ships. And we're talking about firing non-exploding shells at each other, ramming, cutting British nets.
Mm.
But one substitute for that was to play music at each other. And especially came from the British side, where like when they would hail a trawler, the trawler would refuse to identify itself, but instead play Rule Britannia, Britannia Rule the Waves. And somewhat bizarrely, Willie Nelson's The Party's Over.
Yeah. That'll crush him. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Icelanders didn't have the same sort of musical weaponry, but because they didn't have Bjork at the time. And so they were, you know, actually Bjork would really put paid to the British people. But so, yeah, I mean, this is preferable to the kind of open conflict, which did characterize a lot of these Cod Wars. And after the third Cod War, again, Britain basically just had to agree with the rest of NATO and eventually the rest of the world to this whole new way of thinking about our seas. But it's a really interesting thing from an international relations point of view, because first of all, you've got two democratic countries going to Cod War with each other. It's a Cod War, I guess. But it's but also an interesting way in which a small country can force a solution on sort of the wider world.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right. Now, I suppose, though, the classic way of using it is in a siege situation and you're blasting music at people. Now, for instance, Noriega in Panama. How long was he holed up for?
So Manuel Noriega was the de facto dictator of Panama. He had been trained by the U.S. and supported by them until he wasn't. And his sideline was drug dealing, which is what the U.S. eventually got him on. They didn't mind previously, but things changed, people changed. So he holds up in the Holy See's embassy in Panama.
Yeah.
And the Americans don't want to violate the immunity of the Holy See. So they surround him and they bring in big speakers, like South Korean quality speakers, and they play basically whatever the GIs had on them at the time in Marines, including Van Halen's Panama. And Bruce Coburn, who I'm sure did not give his license to this.
I would assure he would be the complete opposite of
If I Had a Rocket Launcher is about American incursions into Central American countries. So I'm pretty sure he was against that, but you know, who knew American soldiers were such fans. But anyway, and then U2, right? Which we can ask them what they thought about that. But they play this for 3 days, like all day and night, and they're landing helicopters and revving their engines. And eventually the Holy See itself goes to George Herbert Walker Bush and says, can you stop? Play with the Van Halen. and they capitulate. But Noriega actually, you know, a week later surrenders.
Yeah.
Goes on trial in the United States.
Yeah. Now, Havana Syndrome. Yes. This is a fascinating thing, especially as they don't know what's causing it.
It is a truly unbelievable thing, which has become incredibly important both to the Trump administration and to the Biden administration. So around 2017, so isn't that long ago, and diplomats and to some extent their families. But what was really strange was that their families were not affected. It was just largely the diplomats. And the Havana Embassy of the United States started experiencing all sorts of, first of all, they'd hear a strange sort of hum or sound or a screeching sound. The sounds involved vary tremendously, possibly because the people's situations vary tremendously. But they then started experiencing quite significant sort of neurological and cognitive issues and symptoms. They eventually do, because they start pressing their government after a while to really get to the bottom of this, because we're talking about over 100 people who are experiencing these symptoms. The Canadian diplomats also suffered from this, and they eventually ended up suing the Canadian government because they weren't supporting them or addressing the issue enough. And there are quite a lot of similarities between what people have, and tests of these people find similar kinds of brain damage. And so people are trying to figure out what is going on, right? Mm. And there have been an incredible number of studies into this. The Trump administration got really onto this. And Trump himself seems to be personally interested in Havana Syndrome. It's also being experienced all over the world at this point.
But only among diplomats.
But among diplomats and some of their families.
Right? Yeah.
America then scaled back its presence in Havana in response. But the Biden administration has also gotten very interested in this. And there have been a lot of different studies of what could possibly be going on. Now, the thing I think probably everybody would sort of be secretly wishing for is that it's either some kind of sound weapon, right, or a microwave weapon, because you can do serious damage to people if you concentrate microwave radiation at them. And other theories involve sort of malfunctioning espionage equipment, There was even a massive sort of microwave attack on the Moscow embassy of the United States with like one really very concentrated burst of microwave energy. So they've done a lot of studies into this, and as has Cuba, right? Mm. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Cuba has found that it was all made up and there's nothing to see here. Mm. But that has been, it's controversial, but that has been often probably the most recent studies suggest that that is the conclusion of other studies done by the United States, which is that these symptoms are sort of either a form of not mass hysteria, but also a bunch of pre-existing conditions, which people could then tag on to Havana syndrome because they were in Havana and diplomats,
yeah.
Other diplomats were complaining about. So they haven't actually found the smoking microwave just yet, mm. But the studies continue. I mean, the people who are suffering from it have not given up.
There's a huge
international interest in this.
Yeah, but the fact that it's only affecting diplomats, you know, it would be really weird if just diplomats have all these kind of pre-existing conditions.
That's true. I mean, yeah. they're a self-selecting sort of population. But
yeah.
No, this is not something, if the world of espionage is such that we know there are whole bases devoted to really wacky technologies in the United States. And we know that they're working on heat weapons, microwave weapons. And we know that this kind of like sound itself can kill you if it's loud enough or
yeah.
if it's concentrated enough. I mean, you know, there's a working assumption that 200 decibels, or maybe is it mega decibels? Anyway, the loudest sound you can make, right, could kill you, right? This is something we know from other contexts. Like if you watch a shuttle going off, like, or a rocket taking off, and you're too close, it's the shockwave which is going to kill you, and the sound could possibly kill you as well.
So just a reminder to listeners to make sure to monitor the volume of your radio. I wouldn't want any blood on my hands. Graham Finley, thanks a million.
Thanks, Sean.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.
When you earn your degree online at Arizona State University, you get everything the nation's most innovative university has to offer. The same internationally recognized faculty, the same nationally ranked programs, the same degree. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.